Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Stone, this is going to be a fun one. We got a full house.
We do have a full house. We even have Entourage and another guest coming. I believe they're caught in traffic, but we're not going to let it slow us down, man. We're going to get this thing going. First up on Atlanta Business Radio, please join me in welcoming to the broadcast, President and Client Success Consultant with Clients First Consulting, Miss Chris Fitch. How are you? I said Fitch. It's Fritch.
It is.
How are you this morning?
I am fabulous. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Well, Chris, can you tell us a little bit about Clients First Consulting? I know we aspire to be put our clients first, so how do you guys pull that off?
Yeah, so we are actually CRM success consultants, and no, that's not an oxymoron. Been around since just over 11 years, and I founded the organization in 2007. And in the last 10-plus years, we've probably helped hundreds of organizations actually succeed with CRM. So we love CRM, and we help our customers love it more or maybe dislike it less. I'm not sure which.
So now tell us about CRM and kind of define the terms for people who aren't don't call it that.
Yeah. So CRM is client relationship management technology or customer relationship management technology. We work with a lot of professional services organizations, so it's typically client for them. Mm-hmm. And that software can have a lot of different features and functions. A lot of people buy it to manage mailing and event lists and to get their word out, basically.
So the software could be Salesforce. It could be Pipedrive. There's a lot of... You're agnostic when it comes to these?
Yeah, I like to call us vendor neutral and client focused. Uh-huh. So we actually are hired by the client. We're not... We know all of the software, but we know the clients better. Our goal is to come in and really get to know the client.
So you don't tell them, hey, switch to this or go to this or we recommend that. You're like, okay, you guys are using this. We're going to make you ninjas at this.
It depends. So sometimes people bring us in to find software or to switch software. But a lot of times we'll come in when they're just not successful with the software. And sometimes some of the research organizations have suggested that up to 70% of CRM implementations fail to meet expectations. The thing is, it's usually the expectations are wrong. So a lot of times we'll come in, for instance, very large organization brought us in, and some of their consultants had said, look, you have software that doesn't work. You're never going to be able to fix it, so you should buy new software. What they didn't tell them was they sell software. And it was going to cost them $1 million+ a year. It's a big organization to get the new software. So what they had us come in is we do a CRM success assessment. So we come in and spend a couple days on site and get to really know all the key stakeholders and talk to them about where they are now, what does success look like, where do they want to be. And then we prepare a report for them. And so before I gave them the report, I said, before we talk about the report, I said, did you notice London's not really having a problem? I mean, we talk to people all over the world, and they said, yeah, it's weird. I said, well, they've done everything right. You know, they didn't roll it out opt-in. People actually were supposed to use it. They trained them, communicated effectively.
So is that a problem that some people have, is they let them opt into it?
Yeah, that's a sure recipe for failure. Yeah, if you roll out a CRM as opt-in, I worked with a law firm, and we got through. They spent all this time and effort and money to do it right. A year later, they're ready to roll out, and the managing partner says, oh, I'm totally bought into this. I'm just not going to share my contacts or use the software. I said, whoa, hold on. So the marketing professional then said to me, well, you know, we're ready to go. It's going to be opt-in. And I said, what do you mean opt-in? I said, you will fail. Just you've wasted all this money. He said, well, you know, because of the managing partner, we have to.
So what did the managing partner want to use, like index cards and a Rolodex?
I actually had one managing partner who said, I'm totally on board with this, except I won't use it. And I said, okay. He said, I don't have a computer. So, you know,
our other guest is covering her face like she can't believe it.
No. He actually had a computer, but this was a law firm, and his assistant really did everything for him.
Right.
So he actually did participate, but it was an interesting conversation.
So, but that's kind of non-negotiable, right? Like the opt-in part, like you have to, everybody has to use it or else you're not getting the data you need. You're not getting the sharing that's needed.
Well, and getting adoption is one of the biggest challenges. In a lot of the organizations we work with, law firms, management consulting firms, you can't mandate behavior. So you can
You can't mandate it because they're kind of all like independent contractee, virtual.
They're all owners of the company,
right?
Or the organization. So a lot of those organizations, you can't mandate that people use it. And even in organizations where you can mandate people use it, oftentimes they don't. I worked for a large organization that spent $12 million on a CRM, and they rolled it out the wrong way. And I worked at another organization where they did it right. So when they did it right, it was, okay, we've got this new tool, and we want to help you be more effective in your jobs with this tool. And so they interviewed us and said, what do you need and what are problems that you're having? And then they said, if you use this software, it'll save you X hours a week. Would you be willing to then share some information for your managers? And we said, sure, because we've got an extra few hours a week.
Right.
In the other organization where they rolled it out wrong, they said, hey, we've got this new tool. You're all going to fly in, spend all this time learning it, and you're going to spend X hours a week putting this data in so your managers can manage you. And no one, $12 million, and no one ever used it. They turned it off 3 years later.
Wow.
So
the stakes are pretty high if you make a wrong choice and the wrong implementation.
Yeah, well, it's a significant investment of time, money, and credibility, frankly. So,
and morale. You're affecting the culture of the company, really.
You are.
So now you got into this, it sounds like semi-accidentally. You got some scar tissue and you saw how it was done right, and you're like, hey, I think I can fix this.
I get into this because I had a bad boss. It's a good story. And thank you to him out there. So, yeah, I had worked with technology forever. I actually went to law school at Emory, but really ended up having a passion for technology. And I guess it's rare to have both, you know, a law degree and a passion for technology. And so I got involved with a couple organizations that worked with law firms and then started my own consultancy after that.
And it was always around CRM?
Actually fell into CRM. I started working with websites and extranets and other technology. Then we acquired a CRM company, and I went and worked there for a bit and said, you know, I think it would be interesting, you know. One of the managers at the company posed this question. He was new, and he said, hey, you know, we've got this great product, and we're pretty proud of it, and we've installed a lot of it, but the customers don't seem to really be using it or be that happy with it. Shouldn't we be helping them succeed? And at the time, that really wasn't the focus. And these software companies are terrific at what they do, creating and implementing and installing and selling software. But what they don't do is get to really know the organization. I like to say the beauty of CRM is it can do 1,000 things. The problem is it can do 1,000 things.
And you may only need to do 11, right?
Three. So I'm like, just have it do 3. Don't try to boil the ocean.
So what are the 3?
Well, it depends on the organization, and it depends sometimes on groups within the organization or even individuals. Sometimes you win this battle one person at a time. Mm-hmm. And so the real key, like when we come in, is we get to know the client and figure out, you know, what are you trying to accomplish? What's your culture like? You know, what does success look like for you? So we get to know them, and we know all the different kinds of software. So we can then help them actually succeed and get buy-in, adoption, and value from the technology, because usually it's not the technology that's the problem when it fails. It's people, process, and change management.
Right.
And so we like to say people, process, and problems first, then products.
Now, what is the when you're working with a new client, typically they have some CRM or they're doing something, right, to keep track of things?
It's all over the board. So people bring us in to help assess the situation and get their first CRM, or you know, a lot of organizations, research organizations, say that up to 70% of CRM implementations fail.
Right.
So they're bringing us in because they're not happy. They don't have adoption.
So they invested in something, and they're like, hey, make this work.
Yes, exactly.
And so when you're doing that, you got to get back to square one of, like, why'd you pick this one and what'd you want to happen, right?
Yeah, and a lot of times people rush right out and say, okay, we need a CRM because we need X. So we're going to let's go watch some vendor demos, pick a piece of software. I've seen software that demos great and has never had a successful implementation. But it's usually the opposite.
Right.
The software works great.
Right.
But 70%+ of the implementations are not are not achieving the desired goals because they didn't take the time to assess their needs individually before they went out and got the software. So you have to buy the software and then wrap it around your business problems or your challenges or whatever you're trying to accomplish. And because it can do 1,000 things, you can do that. I worked with a client 2 years into the implement. They're like, we're going to get CRM, and we did an assessment, but it was 2 years before they were ready to implement, and three CMOs. So the final CMO comes to me. I get her the old assessment. She rereads it. I said, okay, now that you're ready, you need to go back to the managing partner to get the check. I said, and double check, make sure that he still wants to do all these things, and call me back. So she calls me back, and she says, I don't want to do CRM anymore. I said, oh, hold on. 2 years we've been working on this. What do you mean? And she said, well, I talked to him, and what he really wants is to do mailings and events. And I think this is a lot of money to do mailings and events. I want to do all of these, you know, more strategic things. And I said, did he offer to write you a check? And she said, oh, well, of course. And I said, how much was the check? $300,000. And I said, how important do you think these mailings and events are to him? Get the software. You can do all these things next year. But boy, in year one, you better get get the mailings and events done in year one. And so that's what you do with CRM is you start with the big problems. And sometimes those are actually more challenging because you have to roll the software out and train everybody and do that. But then after phase one, you can figure out real business problems by group or by individual. And because it can do 1,000 things, you can do all these other things with the software right out of the box or just with a little bit of configuration.
So now when you're going in there and you're explaining this and we're going to start small and we're going to get one thing done and we're all going to figure out how to get this most important thing done properly and everybody's happy in doing it, you know in the back of your head that the software can do lots of things. You know more than they know. Right, of the capabilities of most of these softwares, right?
Sure.
Because you're in it all the time. How do you kind of move them to really probe to say, you know what, it would be great if it could do blah, blah, blah. And you're like, well, you know, I can make that dream come true, right? Like, isn't that part of the give and take of your consulting when you're working with them?
Yeah. So when we do an assessment, we'll spend, 2 days or more on site getting to interview all the stakeholders, and the people who are in charge of the implementation are in all the meetings, and often they're shocked to hear what everybody says they want it to do. But then we figure out what are the most pressing issues. So I'll put together an assessment document that talks about all their goals as articulated by the different stakeholders in the organization. So, one person might want it to do a pipeline and somebody else might want it to manage events. And so then we sit down and we prioritize the goals, which ones are mission critical and which ones are sort of aspirational, nice to do once we get past it. And the best way to get value is, find a group with a strong leader that really needs the software and get their buy-in and their leadership and implement it, wrap it around, sit down and figure out what they want to accomplish and wrap the CRM around what they want to accomplish and get success. And if you do that with individual groups, then the next group is knocking at your door because they're like, why don't we have this? We need this tool. Well, you have it. You just haven't implemented it.
And you don't know how to use it to its fullest.
Right, exactly.
And then for you, is that typically what happens for you? You get one kind of come in on maybe a smaller project basis to fix one element of it, and then once they see what it can do, then it expands?
Well, we try to be really easy to work with. Sometimes we work on discrete projects. Sometimes we're just helping an organization clean their data. We do a lot of that. But we have something we do that's called CRM Momentum, which is sort of like an ongoing insurance policy for CRM success. So we come in and we work with them perpetually because a lot of times what happens is there's a need right now and they have us come in and we fix it and they're happy and then we go away and things sort of go off the rails again. People get busy. There are other priorities and projects. And so this way they sort of work with us ongoing at reduced rates to really keep that momentum going so they don't sort of fall off and do other things.
So now when you're working with them and you're building kind of the capabilities and helping them achieve the outcomes they desire, you get in there, and are you typically working with these like global companies where this is happening across the world? Is it at one office with 10 people? Like, what does the profile of your client look like?
Sure. So we've worked with consulting organizations, publicly traded, that have thousands of professionals all over the world. And then every once in a while, you know, a solo will call me, and just an individual who wants help with a project. Probably most of the organizations we work with are somewhere in the middle to the large size. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. We cross industries too. We started off working with a lot of law firms and then accounting firms, management right. consulting. But then we worked with a travel and tourism company, and we've gone across industries to find out, it doesn't matter what the industry is, the CRM challenges are the same.
Right. It would make sense that, like, I guess lawyers and accountants and professional services would gravitate first, but now everybody uses CRM, right?
Actually, the professional services industry was one of the last to actually start using CRM. Most businesses have been, you know, really investing millions or billions of dollars in CRM. The professional services arena is a little behind that.
So they're behind because at one point they were just charged with doing work as a lawyer or a CPA, and now they're in charge with, you know, actually selling something too?
Yeah, well, in a lot of these organizations, some of them do have dedicated salespeople, but a lot don't, especially the law firms. And so if you don't have dedicated sales professionals, you don't necessarily have a pipeline. And a lot of people buy CRM just for the pipeline. And that's, you know, the largest organizations in the world all have CRM systems and invest heavily in them.
So I want to hear about the sales and marketing aspect of this thing, because it sounds like these conversations probably go very well once you get a chance to have them. Is the phone just ringing? Are you out there shaking the bushes? How does your sales and marketing thing unfold?
Well, so, you know, we consider ourselves, you know, honored to have a lot of really amazing clients. You know, I spend a lot of time getting to know people. I do a lot of speaking and writing. I do a lot of conferences. I've been actively involved in several industry organizations since 2001. And, you know, just try to help people. And I think it always comes back. So, yeah, you know, we have a lot of referral business, which again, we're honored to have. We have a lot of great, happy clients.
And your team is around the country, right?
Yeah. We have almost 100 people, and a lot of them are virtual. We have quite a few here in Atlanta as well.
The reason I'm asking, and what I'm finding interesting as this conversation unfolds, it's a tech business, but it's grounded in relationships.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And I think sometimes I lose sight of that. But the business can be very technologically oriented, but it all comes down to building and cultivating those relationships and that trust, it sounds like. And apparently you've done that.
Yeah, and I like to say CRM is not a project or an initiative. So you don't just do it and forget about it. It is a fundamental change in an improvement on how the organization manages its most important asset, its relationships. And so, you know, the other thing is it never really ends. It's not a project, but that means you've got forever to get better at it.
Now, does some of your work entail, like, helping them deal with relationships of their clients and their customers?
What do you mean?
Like, these are tools that can automate a lot of things, but in some cases, maybe that wouldn't be the best solution. Is to create impersonal communication rather to move them to some sort of personal interactions.
Well, it's a little bit electronic and a lot personal. So CRM systems exist to track and analyze and manage a lot of data. But the ultimate goal is to help the individual get out and develop business. And a good part of that is face-to-face. But when you're face-to-face, you know, you want to keep notes because we're all so busy. You know, you want to keep notes on the activities. You want to set reminders for follow-up. You want to put in information on the individual so you can remember what's important to them. And you want to sometimes in a sales process attach documents and manage the entire process so that you can have a pipeline of what your revenue looks like. But a lot of this is getting people out of their offices, getting them face-to-face. The actual business development is, you know, face-to-face with clients. But
sometimes don't they use the CRM as maybe a crutch to not do that part because the technology is doing so many things? So, oh, I'm going to send more blast things and I'm going to just kind of bombard people with electronic communication instead of, you know, picking up the phone and calling someone and having a conversation.
Well, the challenge is usually to get them to use the CRM at all. I think the CRM helps them in their jobs. A lot of times the elements, it depends on the size of organization, but a lot of the organizations we work, with the blasts and the event management. That's being done by the marketing department. Mm-hmm. And then in those organizations, the actual people doing the developing of the business or the sales are the individual professionals. And they're also, a lot of them, not salespeople. They want to be working, you know, being lawyers. And this is just something else they have to do. So anything that's technology that can make them more efficient and better at it is great.
Uh-huh.
So one of the things that I like about CRM, and I did come kicking and screaming a little bit into our latest rendition of CRM, but our little organization, we touch a client from several different vantage points. And it's nice to have one central place where information about how we're providing for the care and feeding of our client so that I can go in and look so that I get the data that I need. Katie can go in and look and get the data that she needs. Lee can go in and look. So it really does help facilitate good customer experience, I think, when a team is serving a client, right?
Yeah, assuming you use it and put the data in, that's the challenge. So a lot of our business is trying to find ways to automate getting the data. But if people don't use the system, the data is bad, and you go to get the information, it's not there.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So now, do you have any piece of advice for somebody that's struggling with their CRM?
That's sort of what we do. It depends on the organization and where they are. But the good news is, you know, you've got forever to get better at it. You really want to go in and analyze your situation and figure out, what are the issues that you're trying to fix? What are some of the most pressing issues that the technology can help you with? So I worked with an organization where there was a particular group that said, they hate CRM. They never actually used it, but they hated it. But they had a problem. And I said to the CRM manager, you have a good relationship with this individual. Go talk to him and find out about his problem and listen. Ask a lot of questions and then let him know. We have this technology. I'm going to tell you right now, I know you have some challenges with it. It's CRM. But I really think it can help you solve your problem. And if it can't, I promise we'll do it another way. But give us a shot to see if we can fix it. That group now loves CRM. Mm-hmm. But for them, it's an international experts database. That's all it does for them. And that's okay. And another organization, it's an event management platform. In another place in that organization, it's a mailing list. It's something else. But they all really like it. But it involves someone taking the time to actually sit down with that group and figure out how it could help and then wrapping it around their problem or process.
And then when you start working with somebody, how long does it take before they can see that, okay, this is something that is going to work?
Well, a lot of times it already works, but it could work better. I mean, it depends on what needs to be done. But usually, the ramp-up time, a lot of the systems are cloud-based now. So you don't have to go through what you used to in the past, which was, an entire six-month process where they install and test the software and, can get things up and running a lot faster now.
And then when they start working with you, you go through some sort of assessment to see where they're at, and then how quickly will they see that, okay, we got this now, things are improving? Is that like in 30 days, 60 days, or just like a year?
It depends on the organization. We worked with one organization that we gave them recommendations 2 years ago, and they said, it was kind of a funny story. I said, that if you spent $200,000 fixing your people, process, and data issues, did some training, communicating, took it off being opt-in, you'd be successful. That would probably cost big organization, a couple $100,000. I said, or you can spend $2 million on the software and $1 million a year ongoing. And they're like, yeah, we know, but we're just going to buy new software because that's what they want. And I said, that's okay, because in 2 years, we're going to have this exact same conversation.
Exactly.
And I don't think they bought the software yet. And then we've had organizations that go out, get a cloud-based tool, implement it, start working on it right away, and, they're doing their first e-blast. We're helping them build some of the templates. We do a lot of e-marketing as well. But it's just been a couple months.
So then your service goes beyond just the implementation. You can help them kind of do some of the automation and marketing utility of the CRM as well?
Yeah, we don't actually do implementations per se. I like to say we're not the folks that install things on boxes. or we are the ones that help the software, help you get value out of the software and help it work. So we give them strategy. We do communication planning. We have an entire communication plan from FAQs, leadership documents, right down to some branding campaigns and how to have fun with CRM. Mm-hmm. And a firm that they actually knew Kevin Bacon. And so they ran a branding campaign around the CRM called the 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon. They had Baconator things and pictures of Kevin that you could get your picture with, and they had bacon chocolate bars they passed out. And so they had a little fun with it. So we do all that communication, and then we actually do training, because that's a key part of it. We do a lot of training, and then we actually help organizations clean up the data too.
Good stuff. So if somebody wants to learn more and have more substantive conversation, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
I'm CF, as my initials and the company's initials, at clientsfirstconsulting.com.
And that's clients with an S.
It is clients with an S, and our website is clientsfirstconsulting.com.
All right, Chris Fritsch, keep up the good work.
Happy to do it.
Hey, stay with us. We're going to visit with a couple more guests.
Love to.
All right, next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with a CEO with Book Logix, Miss Angela DeCaris.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, it is an absolute delight to have you in the studio. You and I have traded emails over the years.
We have, yeah.
Because I'm a satisfied client, but we are very interested in learning more about what you guys are up to, mission, purpose. What are you out there doing for folks?
We are helping people to write and publish and market and sell their books. Book Logix is a non-traditional publisher. We're in Alpharetta, so just outside of Atlanta. I know some people think that's a bit of a haul if you're in the perimeter, but we work with folks from all different backgrounds, all different professions, lawyers, doctors, entrepreneurs, folks in healthcare.
CRM, presidents of CRM companies.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, that's on my bucket list. I want to do a book.
Yeah, you should. And really, I mean, you know, nowadays, so many of the hurdles have kind of changed, you know, in our industry that prevented folks from publishing a book easily or quickly before technology and social media and things. So, you know, it's almost crazy for a lot of folks that are in, you know, their industry to not have a book nowadays. So what we can do is take somebody through the entire process, start to finish, even doing the writing of the book for them. You know, if you're a busy professional and you don't have time to sit and write a book, we can actually partner you with a ghostwriter who picks your brain and writes the book for you. We do all the editing, the design, the printing, ebooks. You've got to have an ebook nowadays if you're publishing a book. Selling and marketing, because books don't sell if they're not marketed. I have a lot of folks that self-published a book and come back to us. They hear about us later and they say, well, my book is on Amazon and it's not selling and I have no idea why. There's at least 3,500 books released every single day.
Every day?
Every day, minimum 3,500 books.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that's, I mean, that's a lot of competition, you know, regardless of what genre your book is in.
Right.
So marketing is a real critical part with publishing. So we work with them on the marketing and obviously the selling and fulfillment as well. It's really neat. I'm never bored. We, you know, working with folks from all different backgrounds, and we work with a lot of genres of books. So, you know, there might be, you know, a lawyer might come in one week with a book, and then another week it might be a doctor. We do children's books and all kinds of stuff. So it's really interesting.
Now, you mentioned that the publishing business has changed dramatically over the last probably 20 years at the most, but even probably more.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, it was a dream of people to have a book and you would, you know, submit things to publishers or agents to get a publisher. And then very few people got chosen to be the published author.
Yeah.
And now that's flipped completely. Now anybody can literally publish at any time. Now, why should somebody use a Book Logix as opposed to a, like, going right to Amazon? Mm-hmm. Like, what would be the advantage of working with you guys?
Well, one of the, I guess I'll call it, unfortunate downsides of the self-publishing world and it being now so easy to get a book out there really has been the poor quality of a lot of work that gets published.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of authors, in their excitement and in their rush to put something out there, you know, maybe they have a speaking engagement coming up and they want to make sure their book is out by this certain date. they may skip some things that are really an important part of the process. They may not understand the value of working with a true professional book editor. They may say, oh, my cousin's an English teacher, and they edited the book.
Right. Or worse, you know, my kid is,
yeah,
is good,
I mean,
in English.
I've seen all kinds of stuff, or I had my neighbor's kid do my cover art. And, you know, so really making sure that your book meets the standards of a professional product.
Right, especially if you're a business professional, mm-hmm, and you're doing this.
Yeah,
this
that's
is part
very
of your
important
brand now, right?
Yeah, so working with BookLogix, we really help you to find the balance between, okay, well, we want to get this product out quickly, you know, maybe budget is a concern, but making sure that your book really fits in line with genre standards, with quality expectations of readers of that genre, things like that.
And then do you help, like you mentioned ebooks, and you mentioned, I guess, hardback and, mm-hmm, and paperback books. What about audiobooks? That seems to be a
hot
trend.
We do that as well. Yeah, especially if you live in a place like Atlanta where you're stuck in traffic all day. Yeah, a lot of folks really, you know, ebooks became really super hot. A lot of folks panicked and thought that, oh my gosh, print books are going away. I remember my dad even saying, we need to start buying all the hardcover books we can. They're going away. Actually, we've seen hardcover sales increase, mm-hmm, over the past couple of years. And then a lot of folks are so wrapped up in print and e, they forget about audiobook.
Right.
And audiobook, especially depending on the depending on the genre, is really growing in popularity. It's real easy for somebody to pop an audiobook on their iPhone, pop in their headphones or whatever while they're working out or driving, and be listening to a book. So.
And then you can listen to it at varying speed, so you can, mm-hmm, get through it faster.
Yeah.
And I know we're a little bit biased because of the business that we're in, but in our view, it's also relatively easy to sit down and talk a book.
Very true.
And then get that professionally edited, maybe transcribe it, get it to someone, because it is a way to create a book that
oh, sure,
we've had success with, only.
We've worked with a number of authors that are very talented public speakers, but they can't sit down and actually write long form. So we tell them, you know, give us recordings of speeches you've done, or give us your PowerPoints,
yeah,
or just sit down and talk into your iPhone for, you know, even just 15-minute stretches at a time, just little bits. And you can give that stuff to a ghostwriter, you know, who is really skilled at writing in long form, and they can turn it into an amazing book for you.
Now, is the BookLogix service offering, is it the actual, I'm giving you kind of the content, and then you're putting it in all these various book forms, whether it's e or audio or hardback or whatever, or do you have kind of a network of service providers that help me with the ghostwriting and the book cover and the all the elements that are required to help me be a successful author?
So we do everything except for the ghostwriting right at our facility.
Mm-hmm.
I have three editors on staff, three designers. I have a marketing person, somebody who does the fulfillment and selling and everything. So we're a one-stop shop with ghostwriting. We don't have ghostwriters that work physically out of our building, but we have, you know, some ghostwriters that we trust that we have partnered with on previous projects. And so we'll partner an author with them. But otherwise, I mean, you know, one of the cool things about working with BookLogix as opposed to one of the internet providers, because, you know, there's a lot of them out there, is if you do want an in-person experience and you're in Atlanta, you can literally come to our office and sit and work with your publishing team that is working on your project.
So your team is like in-house,
mm-hmm,
they're doing the work, and you can have that personal relationship.
Yeah,
if you wanted to.
And that's really important. You know, if you've, I've worked with authors who have been working on their book for 10, 20 years. This is their baby.
Right.
They don't want to hand it off to a stranger, you know, so they want that personal connection. They want to know who is my editor and sit and have a conversation with them.
So now what's the biggest challenge for you with all the, it seems like there's so much opportunity now and the ease of doing this, that a lot more people are doing this.
Yeah, there are. You know, I think for us, one of our big missions is really helping the reputation of non-traditional publishing. You know, as I mentioned earlier, because some people skip parts of the process and there's a lot of books that were non-traditionally published that are lacking in quality in some ways. It's really important to us to help educate authors and really help them to raise standards of non-traditional publishing. So we do a lot of workshops, webinars. You know, I speak at different conferences and things to really just educate an author. I think your book actually has a better chance of success as well if you are more educated on the do's and don'ts and trends in the industry, things like that.
Now, do you help the person, like say it's that professional service person that's out there doing work and they go, okay, you know, my marketing person says I need to write a book because that'll help me get more speaking. It'll get me more business. Do you help them kind of from that marketing standpoint to help them get a book that's going to help them do that?
Yeah, we can. We've worked with authors at all different stages in the process. So some of them have literally nothing. and we can coach them and help them put together an outline, you know, guide them in the writing or partner them with a ghostwriter and take them through all the way through the rest of the process, marketing and selling. Other folks come to us and they've written something, but maybe it needs a little TLC. You know, they've kind of got, you know, a good premise, a good start, a good outline, but they're not really sure where to go. And then other folks have everything ready to go, and maybe they just need to plug and play with a few of the services we offer, because everything we do is a la carte, so you can pick and choose from anything that we have.
And then if I have content already and maybe it's not perfectly polished, I can give you that, and then you can kind of, you know, just kind of massage it to make
Yeah, we start with doing an editing sample. So we'll edit a few pages of an author's manuscript if they have a manuscript ready to go. Just to kind of, it's almost like when you have a sore throat and you go to the doctor. And you know something's wrong, but right. You're not sure exactly what. So our editor can almost be your doctor and kind of diagnose, you know, maybe give some advice or kind of guide you or tell you literally what level of editing that we offer that's a good fit for you.
And then the amount of time this takes from your end, it's not that much. But for me, like you said, some people work on their books for 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen all kinds of things. People that wrote a book for 10, 20 years. I've had other folks that wrote a book literally in a matter of a couple of weeks because they had time off or something and they just said, I am going to just lock myself in a room and do it. The publishing process, on average, takes about 3 to 5 months. I've seen less. I've seen more now. If you're working with a ghostwriter and writing the book, that's going to add a lot of time on. But it's an average of about 3 to 5 months.
And then, so walk me through. I'm a lawyer in Atlanta and I want to have a book. So what do? I call you guys. What happens next?
Yeah, call us. And a lot of times we're just going to start with a consultation. We want to learn more about you, about your profession, about your goals. You know, why are you publishing this book? And I hate to say it, but if you come to me and you say you're doing it just to, you know, make $1 million or whatever, you know, that's a difficult goal. So tell me, how is this going to help your business? You know, how are you going to package this into your offer?
So you don't promise me being a bestseller author?
No, I wish I could. I really wish I could.
I don't know. On the internet, I get that all the time, that I can be a best-selling author. I just have to click something.
You know, it's so unfortunate because BookLogix is smaller. We're a privately held company. A lot of folks don't find us until they've been burned by somebody else, especially a big internet company that makes crazy promises. I always advise authors, watch out. If somebody's promising you that you're going to be a bestseller and they haven't even looked at your manuscript yet, that's a little iffy to me, you know? So we would want to start with a consultation. You know, what are you hoping to accomplish with this book? What materials do we have to work with? Have you written anything yet? You know, are you a public speaker? How is this going to fit into your branding? Also, time frame is a big thing. How quickly are you hoping to have this book out, you know, and what's reasonable?
Now, do you help me, like I'm that lawyer and I want a book, but I don't know what, are we going to kind of go back and forth and figure out what is the best topic for this? Or like, you're going to help me with the title? Like you're
yeah,
helping me
we can
in
do
every
all
step
of that.
Of the way?
Yeah, it's as much or as little. Our team is very flexible. You know, we've seen all kinds of scenarios over the years. So we adapt to fit into what works best for you, because I have some authors that have nothing to work with, and I have other folks who know title and everything, and it's written and ready to go. So we kind of plug and play with what you're needing.
And then if I work with you guys, am I still going to have access to Amazon? Like, is this stuff going to get on all these online platforms?
Yeah, we sell all of our authors' books on Amazon, submit to Barnes & Noble. We have some of our authors who have their books in Barnes & Noble stores, working with independent bookstores. You know, Amazon is the number one seller of books, love them or hate them. But there's a lot of options out there. A lot of folks also don't realize, you know, especially if you're a public speaker. I have some folks that think, I'm going to be a bestseller on Amazon. Well, if you're an established public speaker, you may actually sell a lot more books when you speak versus online to, you know, an audience that doesn't know you. Also, nobody sits at home searching through, you know, millions of books on Amazon all day. Generally, they hear about a book and then they go on Amazon and purchase it. They say you have to hear about a book 7 or 8 times before you will make a conscious buying decision. So if you're doing other kinds of marketing, that's going to help you a lot more than just, you know, plunking your book on Amazon.
And when you have a book, do you happen if I, as part of my marketing strategy, is to give away an ebook or a dollar ebook or some one of those things?
Yeah, so
does
we
it
do
work
a lot.
In your platform it, as well?
Yeah, depending on the genre, especially, we do all kinds of things with, you know, free ebook campaigns or sales or giveaways. You know, it's really, especially if you're a first time author, building up that buzz or that awareness, giving, you know, a lot of authors think, well, why on earth I put all this effort in and I spent this money to put the book together? Why do I give it away? It's a great marketing tactic, especially really trying to get reviews on Amazon, that's hard. And they say you need at least 50 reviews on your product page on Amazon to really start to get traction in search results and things like that. So giving your book away can really help with that.
And then so you know some of these tactics to help me get the word out and help me kind of have my book have the best shot of success.
Yeah. And that's where, you know, the marketing will work with you on coaching and kind of advising you on the best marketing strategy for your genre of book. Because what works for one person and one book is not going to work for another person with the same type of book. So we have all different tactics that we'll work with an author on.
Well, that was fun talking about the lawyer and all, but let's talk about me, or at least us, right?
Yeah.
So I've got this self-published book that I put out, and I did go with a bigger outfit. It didn't work out too well. Came back with a second printing, and have had great success with it. With you guys, did not make $1 million with it. Was not the objective,
right? Right.
But it has helped me command higher speaking fees. It's helped me serve clients, and it's even given me credibility, even though it has nothing to do with radio. Or anything that we do here, it's still a credibility piece even now for me. But let's talk about us. for Lee and I, and Lee published a book some years back as well, so we both have that. Each of us have a book under our belt. But maybe it's time for us, and you know, maybe we can't write, maybe we talk it. But we could talk a book about how to leverage this platform to help people and make money.
Yeah.
Okay, but so we would first, though, we should just sit down and talk with you.
Yeah, just right? Brainstorming, you know, just bouncing ideas and figuring out what makes the most sense. Also looking at, you know, I have a lot of authors that say, well, you know, my book is just like The Help. Well, why would you write a book that's just like The Help? Your book should be different. It should be unique. It should be something that other people aren't saying or doing to help people. So, you know, we would want to take a look at what is out there on the topic already. You know, how can you guys stand out and be different and say things that other people are not saying?
Which would be a very important conversation because, you know, when Lee started this, he had to explain what digital radio was. Nobody knew what a podcast was. Now everybody and their brother thinks they know something about podcasting. So we'd need to think through that. So that was one thought that I had. The other was we have clients who host their own shows. It's one of the ways that our business works. You know, I've got a lady who hosts a show every Friday morning aimed at middle market CEOs and their most trusted advisors. Couldn't she take some of that content, get it in your hands, and you guys massage it?
Absolutely.
Turn it into a book, maybe bookend it with some commentary by her. I'm just... My wheels are clicking, Lee, and I'm thinking maybe we should make a more conscious effort to create a more direct path or some sort of combined offering where we team up with these folks.
Yeah, if you have content, if you blog regularly, write articles, things like that, do radio show, podcast, whatever, I mean, you've got content ready to go. It might need to be tweaked to fit more of a book format, but that's content you've already put the work and effort into doing, and an editor can easily help you to adapt that for book format.
And then it can be systematized. Like you said, if I'm a blogger and I'm already doing this, I know every year I'm doing the 2018 best of the blog, and that's going out. Now I have different editions, and then that's a lot of content. It could be another passive revenue stream for me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's so many different things you can do once you have that book. You know, some folks give it away as just kind of a, you know, hey, read my book. If you like what you read in the book, use my services. Other folks are packaging it in with their services or they're selling it at speaking engagements. I mean, there's so many different options once you have that book.
All right. So in just a moment, we're going to do take one of the Beltline book. But before we do, let's make sure that our audience knows how they can reach out, have a conversation with you, learn more about this process, and maybe set up one of those initial conversations. So best coordinates, email, LinkedIn, whatever's appropriate.
Yeah, website is the best place to start. It's BookLogics, BookLogix.com.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming and visiting with us this morning. And I'm quite sincere in I'd like to explore this a little bit, a little bit further offline.
Yeah.
All right. Stay with us. We're going to visit with one more guest. All right.
Thank you.
All right, Lee, you ready for the headliner?
I am.
He came with his own entourage, his own paparazzi, and he actually kind of strolled in here like Babe Ruth, you know, a little bit after we went on air, but he's all smiles. He's the best dressed in the studio, and we're delighted to have him. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast Director of Economic Development with Atlanta Beltline, Inc., Mr. Gerald Mitchell. How are you?
Good morning. How are you? I'm good.
I am doing well. What'd you learn in those last couple of segments? Did you pick up anything?
Well, I think the biggest thing that I picked up was these the bacon chocolate bars. That's a great idea.
You hooked him there, Chris.
And I'm also thinking about writing my economic development book now.
Excellent.
All right.
So now tell us about the Beltline. How are you serving folks up there?
Yeah, so the Atlanta Beltline, for those who aren't familiar with it, is the largest redevelopment project in the city of Atlanta's history. We're endeavoring to redevelop 22 miles of mostly abandoned rail corridor around the city of Atlanta. That means building out a network of trails and transit. And also, for me more specifically, it's working to reactivate properties around the Atlanta Beltline that may have been traditionally disinvested or didn't have a terribly lot of activity happening. So to further that, we're working to do things like attract new jobs, which is my role. We're trying to attract new private investment, which is also my role. We're working to encourage the development of 5,600 affordable units and almost 30,000 overall new residential dwellings around the Atlanta Beltline. We'll also have a streetcar that will traverse that 22-mile loop and also have connectivity to a broader transportation grid around the city of Atlanta and also have connectivity to MARTA as a part of the city's mobility plan.
Now, when the idea came about, it wasn't that long ago, right? It was Ryan Crivell?
It was almost 20 years ago, believe it or not.
Is that when he wrote the...
That's when he wrote the thesis. He was a Georgia Tech student in city and regional planning, working on his master's. And he wrote a thesis that really looked at how this part of Atlanta could be reactivated or revitalized. And, you know, I'm assuming he graduated and passed this course. But he, after he graduated, started to circulate his thesis among city council. And I think he heard no a lot. And eventually, Kathy Woolard was able to get the attention of the rest of city council and, at the time, Mayor Shirley Franklin. And that turned into an authorizing ordinance that became what we are now, the Atlanta Beltline, Inc.
And then the Beltline is a big circle, right?
Correct.
And the part that's live right now is a small segment of that.
Well, right now we've got about 11 miles of the entire that are traversable, safely traversable. We've got about 4 miles on the east side trail. We've got a little more than 4 miles on the west side, including connector trails. We've got a mile in Collier Hills on the north side of Atlanta. We've got a hiking trail, a northeast, which traverses just north of Piedmont Park all the way up to very close to Sweetwater Brewing. Mm-hmm. So we've got a lot of activity. Some of it is hardscaped Beltline. Some of it is in the graded, cleared state where it's not fully built out, but it is still usable as an interim trail.
But the, I guess one of the first areas that were really built out was like from Pond City Market to Croc Street area.
Correct, yes.
And is that how you envision the entire Beltline eventually turning into that kind of gentrified? It's almost like an outdoor mall for, I don't know how far that is, that over a mile?
Yeah, so that that mature section of the Atlanta Beltline is 2.25 miles. We've just worked through phase one of an extension, and we're mm-hmm. working through phase two of that extension that'll take it all the way down to Memorial Drive. And yes, that has had a lot of very positive investment and new activity start to occur. And we do look at that from a technical standpoint as what the Atlanta Beltline looks like everywhere. But from a broader community-facing standpoint, we think that the Atlanta Beltline will look different in various neighborhoods around the city because we also want to be respectful of the different cultural aspects, the different things that align or abut the Beltline in these different areas. Some areas are very dense in residential, single-family residential mm-hmm. dwellings. We expect those areas to stay that way. Some areas are very dense in commercial activity, and we expect those areas to continue to look that way and hopefully thrive. And then there are some areas where we think we're going to have to take on a role of what we call market maker, where some of these areas are more distressed. There's not a lot of activity, and some of the things that are going to take place in the future are going to be more organic. You know, as it relates to, again, a great example would be, for instance, Southwest Atlanta, where if you look at the West Side Trail near Lee Street and Murphy Avenue, Avenue. That's a part of the Beltline where there isn't a whole lot of activity. It's a former industrial area. And, you know, during the recession and frankly, in some areas, way before the economic downturn occurred, you know, businesses started to leave for various reasons. So we anticipate that areas like that will take on something different in terms of its form and its level of activation. Some of those areas will start to see the rise of multifamily dwellings. Some of those areas will start to take on the shape of dense job creating districts. And then, you know, some of them will just be mixed. You know, you'll see a lot of different activity. So we're looking forward to that.
And then, so that's just the natural kind of evolution of this. I guess some of this is pave it and they will come, right? Kind of thinking where you put the area there and people have access, and then people will figure out the best use of it over time.
I think that's right. At the end of the day, I think one of the things that we try to make sure that we communicate is that the Beltline doesn't belong to the Atlanta Beltline, Inc. It belongs to the community. We're building this for the community. So we have a very robust community outreach arm or department within the Atlanta Beltline that does a lot of outreach and meeting with the various communities. By the way, we touch 45 neighborhoods throughout the city of Atlanta, and we're meeting with all of them.
They have a lot of opinions.
They have a lot of opinions. That's absolutely right. But we want to know what they think. We want to know where they'd like to see more density. We'd like to see where there are certain areas where it's going to be you know, a topic of sensitivity, you know, that a view might be blocked.
Well, a lot of people don't like change, and then this is a pretty big disruption into their life. And even though they might live in an area that's kind of rough, and you put this in there, and then they see Pond City, and they're like, are you transforming my little kind of getaway into this now? There's thousands of people. You go there, I mean, it blows my mind. If you had been to that area before the Beltline, and then you go there now, it's a different world.
I live there. It's amazing.
Right.
But there's traffic.
Right. But the people who lived there before you, some people weren't that thrilled that that was there. You know, that wasn't that simple of a move to say, oh, yeah, well, this makes perfect sense. We're all in. It wasn't that easy to get done.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, and that was one of the biggest benefits of really achieving community support and achieving private sector business support. For the East Side Trail, the reality is that when this concept was floated publicly, people had no idea what it would look and feel like. And the East Side Trail really did serve as some level of proof of concept.
Right.
That building this type of amenity would be, generally speaking, a good thing.
I mean, it's transformative. I mean, you created an area out of nothing almost.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, historic Fourth Ward is a great example of that. If you look at the historic Fourth Ward Park, one of the things that was prevalent in that area was flooding. And now if you go to the historic Fourth Ward Park, there's a beautiful water feature mm-hmm. there in the middle of the park. And what it really did is it was an infrastructure improvement that alleviated flooding in that entire node. So it opened up the opportunity that some of the desolate or barren property around that area would be put into better and more productive use. So, again, this is, I think, a great example of how we can do something good by making infrastructure improvements to things in our communities that aren't producing anything.
Right. But it's to have the vision to do that. I mean, those rails were sitting there forever.
That's
and
right.
Nobody was looking at them, and they were, you know, an eyesore.
Yep, that's right.
And then to really be this bold and to take this kind of action to make something like that appear is just, it transformed that whole area.
Absolutely. We're proud of it. And we believe that while we've achieved that or accomplished that level of success on the east side, that we've got so much more work to do and so many more people to touch. And we believe that the impact of what we're doing can be huge. We want it to be.
Now, are you seeing other communities kind of embrace this thinking around the trails and utilizing the same opportunity?
Absolutely. It's almost like you've been prepped with these questions. Frankly, last week, we had a group in, and there's a group that exists. It's called the Highline Network. And some people may not be familiar with it, but there's another project. You know, their project is 4 miles. Ours is 22.
just saying.
But it's the New York High Line.
And, right. That connects to Chelsea
Exactly. But there's a group of other large infrastructure projects around the country, like the Chicago 606, the River LA project, the Detroit River project, the Low Line in New York, the Underline in Miami. All of those projects actually convened in Atlanta last week. And we had the opportunity to do a lot of sharing in terms of lessons learned, things that have gone really well with the Beltline, things that we've run up against that haven't been, you know, the most positive things about what we've done and how we're trying to work through those things, too.
And then it's funny because before the Beltline, I guess, was the Silver Comma Trail, right? And that was a trail that goes from, I guess, the Cobb County area all the way to Alabama, I believe.
Exactly.
And that's, what, 50-something miles as well?
I believe it's 56 or 57 miles.
And that's another use of the trail, not as the Beltline, but again, it's just repurposing something that existed and transforming it into something else, and now it's a pretty active...
Absolutely. Absolutely. And by the way, right now the Beltline looks like a loop or a circle, or some people call it a pear, some people call it a heart. But ultimately, it looks more like a sun, we think, because not only would we look at the Silver Comet Trail, but we would look at the Stone Mountain Trail and the Lionel Hampton Trail and just other trails around the metro or around the region, ultimately connecting into the Atlanta Beltline. Giving us a much broader network, Path 400, just a lot of different opportunities to drive a greater level of regional connectivity.
And then you're getting people out of cars into other forms of transportation. Are you seeing, I mean, any of the, with the advent of all of these scooters and bikes and stuff, how is that, how are you guys managing that? Because that, I mean, it's a double-edged sword.
That's a really good question. So what we ask, so technically there are no electric vehicles permitted on the Atlanta Beltline.
Technically?
Technically, in the sense that there, you may see them there.
I mean, look like they're there, but you're not. They're not there.
our real rule is kind of the golden rule, right? It's just be respectful rather, of other people that are out and about on the trail. If you're out there and your bike or your electric scooter goes 30 miles an hour and there are, you know, 5,000 other people on the trail that are walking, it's probably not a good idea to go 30 miles an hour.
Right, even though it can.
Even though it can. So our biggest message to that constituency is, you know, great, use the Beltline to get from point A to point B. That's what we intended. But please be respectful of other people that are using it as well.
And then this is a challenge, I'm sure, that when you were speaking with that group from people all over the country, they're dealing with this as well.
Exactly. And they're at different stages. So one of the things about the Beltline that Atlanta should be proud of is that we're further along in building our amenity than most of these projects. The New York High Line is probably the furthest along. But we started first, and because ours
and those are shorter.
There's a shorter. And because of that, you know, we're still in progress. They're finishing the final leg of the High Line now. But again, you know, I think the people of Atlanta, the people of the Atlanta Metro should be really proud in that we're doing something that the rest of the country is starting to embrace and trying to figure out how they can best make it work for them and their communities. And we've got a lot of communities around the Southeast and other parts of the country that aren't just looking at this type of concept. They're looking at how to activate distressed waterways or historic districts or other things. And again, I like to say this when I do presentations, but this is certainly something that, in my opinion, any community can do.
Right.
And it's one of the ways that we...
But it requires a public-private kind of collaboration here. It's very difficult for only one of those constituents to really make this happen. You need buy-in from the residents.
Right.
You need buy-in from business to invest in that. And then you need the politicians to, you know, put their neck on the line a little bit and go for it.
That's absolutely correct. You know, the Beltline does not operate in a vacuum. We're a Georgia nonprofit development corporation that was created by the city of Atlanta to implement this project. So you're absolutely right. The success of the Beltline isn't because a lot of smart people work at Atlanta Beltline, Inc. It's because we've had political will to get this done, and we've had community support to drive this. And one of the things that I think our leadership and our organization would definitely want me to say is that we've also had pretty good philanthropic support. Organizations like the Coca-Cola Foundation, Coca-Cola, Arthur Blank Foundation, Candida, Home Depot, all of those organizations and many others have also been a big part of what we're doing. Cox, we could not do this without a collective effort. And, you know, again, Jenny's looking at me over there. The PATH Foundation's been a great partner. Trees Atlanta, Park Pride. Again, the list is endless. And we couldn't do this without all of those organizations wanting to be a part of it.
And it's amazing that one Georgia Tech student with kind of this crazy idea was the domino that fell that has now made this, multi-billion dollar endeavor happen. I mean, it's crazy, isn't it?
It absolutely is. Absolutely is. And, I look at the numbers. I have some really interesting perspective on the numbers. When I look at, the fact that when I look at $10 million projects around the Atlanta Beltline, we've seen over $4 billion in reinvestment into the areas around the Beltline. And that's roughly within half a mile on either side of the Atlanta Beltline. And again, we're not even looking or talking about at this point projects that the construction expenditures were less than $10 million. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of those. And we've got a pipeline in terms of announced projects of an additional $4 to $5 billion that are sitting on the sidelines, either in planning or in architectural design, so in different phases or states. So again, the money that the city is spending, the city and the county and APS are spending to get this done.
They're investing. They're not spending.
You're right. They're investing. Thank you. That is really, I think, paying forward when you look at it in the context of the activity that's being generated and the additional value that's being created for the community.
So now, what do you need more of? How can we help?
Radio, book publishing, and CRM.
Is what I was thinking. Those things covered.
And bacon chocolate bars. So again, from our standpoint, we did a survey earlier this year, community survey, and that community survey suggested that over 80%, that we have over 80% support from the community. But that has to continue. They wanted us to, while they support what we're doing, only 3% thought that this was a waste of tax dollars. What they suggested was that we do a few things. They wanted us to build more trail faster. They wanted us to build out the transit network faster. And they want us to keep an eye on affordability. They want this to remain a project and an amenity that everybody can take part in, mm-hmm. that everybody can use. And we heard that. So that community support, again, is a huge, huge piece of what it's going to take on a continuous basis for us to keep doing the work that we do. Obviously, funding continues to be something that we want to get better at, because again, we're talking about a almost $5 billion project. And because of the economic downturn, we missed several years of growing funding.
Right, some momentum.
Exactly. So funding sources. Again, we have to be open to public-private partnerships. We want those to come to bear. We want partners to show up. We want to start to talk about how we can advance partnerships to further deliver this project.
Now, is the Gulch part of this, or that's a separate entity?
The Gulch is a separate entity. It's not a part of the Atlanta Beltline. What we call it is the planning area or overlay. Mm-hmm. It is not. The Gulch is not included.
But it's a similar type project, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the sense that that it's a piece of property that has a tremendous upside in terms of what it becomes and how it begins to impact.
But it was former rail as well.
Correct, right? Correct.
So it was like some of the same elements, but it's just a different project.
Exactly. So, again, you're absolutely right. You're hitting the nail on the head. It's an opportunity to, again, re-envision how something that might not be producing can become productive, right, for the community.
And that everybody wants to get theirs in there and want to make sure that it's serving everybody as best they can.
Right.
Which is hard to do. I mean, that's where the vision takes place and the political will,
yep,
to make these things happen.
That's exactly right.
Exciting times for Atlanta. I mean, something's got to be done to alleviate some of this traffic. So the Beltline, to me, is part of the answer.
I think you're right. I think this this transit component is huge. And from a last-mile connectivity, that's where I think the trail has the biggest impact.
Right. And it's amazing. I know these scooters are a pain, but they really do help that last mile. That does make things possible where people are going. They're not getting their car. They're going by scooter to go to eat and leave right. their thing, get another one. That's a pretty clever solution to this.
Right. It really is. It really is. And, you know, speaking of clever and innovative, you know, that's one of the things that we're working through as well. It's how we can more effectively have the Atlanta Beltline be viewed as kind of a test bench for innovation.
Right.
So...
Now, if somebody wants to learn more, what's the best way to learn more about what you guys are up to?
I think the best way is to take a look at our website. It's www.beltline.org. I can be reached either via LinkedIn, Gerald Mitchell, and that's Gerald with a J. We can also be reached on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram.
Of course.
the usual suspects.
And that's, what is it, Beltline? At atlbeltline.org is the website, I think.
It's beltline.org.
Beltline.org,
yep.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you so much.
All right, this is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton and all our guests today. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.